Hi, this is comedian Mary Santora, and you're listening to The Default Setting with Jess Falstick and Elizabeth Seaman. Enjoy.
Welcome to The Default Setting, where we find out what makes you tick because we have ways of making you talk. I'm your host, Jess Falstick, and our co-host, Elizabeth Seaman, will be here shortly. She's just paying the bill at Barrio. I want to welcome our guest. She is a comedian. She's in Cleveland. She's a mom. We're going to learn a bunch more things about her today. Ms. Kelly Thulis, how are you?
Oh, hello. I'm doing good.
Did I say your name correctly?
Thanks for having me. You then, yeah, Thulis.
Yes. All right, sweet.
Yes.
I always have this, like, panic, because I just say shit. Like, I go into the introduction, and I'm, like, you know, not even thinking about the fact, and then all of a sudden I'll be like, Mr., or, like, Ms., and then I'm like, oh, my God, like, I'll be realizing it as the words are tumbling out of my mouth, like, oh, my God, I don't know how to say this name, so I'm just going to say it with confidence, and we'll see how that goes.
Well, the worst was always hosting open mics. I would do that for many years, and people would write down their names, and I was like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Can't read that. That name.
Your default setting is film and TV lover.
Yes.
I love that. Give me, this is a great, like, this is awesome to kind of go back to the beginning with, because you can kind of talk about the first films you remember seeing and the ones that really sat with you.
Well, so, I mean, it stems all the way back. My first word was TV.
What?
From what I've been told. Yeah, so that was my very first word.
So
it comes way, way back. From the beginning.
I love it.
I mean, probably the first film I really remember watching was Pinocchio.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's just because it was such a weird, creepy film or what, but I mean, that one just, like, stood out as something I remembered watching as a kid.
Yeah.
For no particular reason, though, or love for it. Just all sorts of films. I was obsessed with Muppets. We talked a little bit about that pre-episode, but I was definitely obsessed with Muppets. I was also really obsessed with Saturday Night Live at an age that was kind of a weird thing. Comedy in general, like, Monty Python. I was also very,
yes,
very obsessed with Monty Python. And in middle school. So I was, like, walking around my little Catholic school playground. I had a microcassette tape recorder that I would, like, record little bits from shows that I thought were, like, interesting and funny, and I wanted to, like, really listen to it over and over again. So I'd be walking around the playground, like, playing this, you know, bits about, I don't know, just something silly. Sorry, my daughter's like,
no, you're fine. Oh, she's so little. Look at her. Hi, sugar. It sounds like TV, both TV and film sort of hit you about the same time. You didn't really have one or the other.
No, but, and I think that was probably right during the time where VHSs and, you know, were really popular. So I think they both were blending into each other that I had both. I was just obsessed with those kind of things from an early age, and even though growing up I wasn't particularly sure what I wanted to do with my life, I knew it was within those realms. And then I know I went through a phase too where I was choosing my careers based off of whatever movie I just watched.
Okay.
So, like, for career days, I was like, oh, I definitely want to be an archaeologist from like the 1930s with Brendan Fraser. Or I want to be a wedding planner with Matthew McConaughey and Jennifer Lopez. I don't know. One of those just totally scattered choices. Hey, totally scattered choices all over the place. It was always based on whatever films I was watching, until it was actually the thing that made me realize that people actually did this as a living was I had a VHS copy of The Mummy.
Okay.
And at the very, very end of the credits, there is a making, like, behind-the-scenes little short film that they made.
Okay.
And at that time, there was, like, no access to that kind of stuff. Now you could watch that and, you know, just follow any film you're interested in on social media. And they're always posting that stuff.
Yep.
But, and...
Back in our day, kids. Back in our day.
Back in our day, you had to wait till the end of the credits of the VHS to maybe see something. Mm-hmm. Maybe.
And you had VHS! Yeah.
And, then we had to rewind it. My God, the past was horrible. What we lived through.
I know.
But yeah, no, that little documentary was one of those things that made me go, oh my God, people actually do this as a job. Like, this is something, like, people do. Yeah. And so it just got me really interested in it, and I went on from there.
That's so cool, though, because what you're saying is, like, I love how you're talking about, how, like, the career of the protagonist in the film was, like, what you wanted to be, and then you change it to another film, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh, no, wait, I can be all of these things if I go into entertainment. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I don't have to choose anything. I'll be them all.
Exactly.
all of them.
I love that. And it sounds like you gravitate a lot towards comedy and action.
I mean, a little bit. I'm like, I'm spanning over. I'm like looking at my DVD collection over there, which I refuse to give up. I was at a White Elephant gift party just last night. Somebody handed out a stack of DVDs, and I was like, I will steal those. That's what I'm stealing. I'm taking those.
That's good.
And everyone's like, really? You want the DVDs? I'm like, these are artwork. I love it. Like, the entire case, the way people thought about the entire, like, design of the case and the DVD. I don't know. I love that kind of stuff. Yeah. Even I was cracking up, one of the copies was Vanilla Sky, and, like, the tagline for Vanilla Sky, I never realized, was just, like, one long word that's, like, love, sex, hate, friendship, love. And it's, like, so important to the designer that on the front and the side of the DVD case, it's, like, one word. I don't know. Anyway, they nerd out over that kind of stuff, because I just think it's interesting thought process of whoever designed that.
That's such a good point. Oh, my God. So that brings up a really good thing that I've sort of run into is... it hasn't ruined it, but it's made it weird. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but, like, being involved in the filmmaking process and whatever element that is, and, you know, especially if it's across multiples, because I think a lot of people get involved in multiple ways, but
when
anytime I watch anything now, it doesn't matter. I stop paying attention to what the fuck the film's about and start analyzing the acting, the editing, the sound, the, you know, lighting.
Yeah.
And the thing that you had just mentioned about the DVD cases never occurred to me that someone had to actually, like, a group of people had to sit down and, like, plan what that's supposed to look like and how it's supposed to be
designed.
What
it's going
to
look like.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There's Elizabeth! So you were talking about how you grew up enjoying, like, Pinocchio and Monty Python and all those sorts of things. And I believe I stupidly cut you off earlier. We were talking a little bit about what you tend to gravitate toward. You know, is there genres that you tend to gravitate toward, or are you really just, are you a lover of all things film and TV?
I mean, I'm a lover of all things film and TV, but it's definitely comedies that I gravitate towards more. And then and like I said, a little bit of, like, the action. Like, the action comedies, though, I love those.
Okay. Naked Gun, that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah, those are fun. Yeah. I like those ones.
The one that kind of surprised me that was funny was, like, 22 Drum Street. Like, the remake.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the 21 and 22 Drum Street. This is funnier than it feels like it should have been.
Yeah, than we expected. It was funnier than what we expected it to be. Our expectations were low for it, and we're like, no. One of my favorite films that we actually, I just got married in October. Yeah, my bachelorette party, my sister rented out a movie theater in Akron. There was a hotel with a movie theater inside of it, and we all watched The Birdcage.
Exactly.
Oh, got in pajamas and watched The Birdcage. I was like, this is exactly what I want.
Oh my God, that sounds so fun. I'm really jealous
about it. Yeah. I love Mike Nichols and Elaine May, and so them together in a film, working together in a film was like, yeah. And then you have Robin Williams and Nathan Lane. I mean, that film's just great.
Good.
So I quote that all the time. It's almost like to get kind of people don't know. But it's a bit like, you know, sometimes you just gotta say, pierce the toast. So what? I could just give more toasts.
There's so many great subtle moments in that film. Like, one of my favorite moments isn't even a line. All it is just, like, Nathan Lane walks in as the reveal of Nathan Lane in the disguise, and you see the camera just slowly pan in on Robin Williams' crazy eye. Just, like, every cut, it's a little bit closer in on him, just panicking silently, and it's, like, that's one of my favorite moments of the entire film, and there's actually no dialogue to it. There's nothing I can quote. It's just the Robin Williams' crazy eyes.
I like the part where he, like, comes in, like, with his suit on, but then he just crosses his legs, and he's, like,
oh, yeah, and he's with the pink socks. And yeah. It's a great film, and it's one of those films, too, that, you know, it was pointed at the time, and I feel like it still has important lessons to it about family coming together and acceptance, and, you know, it's one of those things that, like, we watched it here in 2019, and it was like, oh, wow, geez, still need to hear this. That's sad that this is, like, still such a culturally important film.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting because, like, when I thought about it, like having watched it more recently, I'm like, well, like, yeah. they don't show Nathan Lane and Robin Williams really, like, showing, like, any, like, really physical affection at all.
No. So no, like, well, yeah, the most is, like, them holding hands. That's it. And
Yeah. So I wonder if that was, like, them time. Saying, like, we're going to, you know, they're gay, but we can't, like, put it in people's faces.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like in the 90s, it wasn't really, you couldn't do much more than that, unfortunately.
As recently as Modern Family, like when people used to talk about how they wouldn't show Mitch and Cam kissing, and then they actually had, like, this big deal where they're like, tonight's the episode where Mitch and Cam are going to kiss, like, and that was, like, within the last 10 years. So it's taken a lot. I think we're finally getting there. I know I'm... My brain, I realize, is at a point where it's still, if men start kissing on TV, like, it goes, whoa, but then it's just like, aw. Like, that's where my brain is at, just because of what we're used to seeing, effectively. So I was like, well, I'm glad that we're at least getting to a point now where it's not, like, shocking. It's just kind of, like, we're still wired to find it a little, like, jolting, but then you immediately react as just like, oh, this is just, like, adorableness or sexiness or whatever the hell's going on in the scene.
Like, a couple.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like we really missed out, though. I mean, Robin Williams and Nathan Lane, two comedy gods. I wanted to see them kiss. That would have been all right. Oh, hell yeah. That would have been great.
That would have been so
loved that.
I want to see one of them touch the other one's butt. Like, that would have been hilarious.
Oh my god. So do you do, like, because I know one of my things, I'm weird. Mm-hmm. I'm much more of a TV buff than a film buff, which is
okay,
which is bad, I know, just because I would love to get into film. But, like, do you find, because I know that when my ex-husband and I were together, we actually would embark on, like, these projects where, like right after we got Netflix, I think right after it came out, we decided to watch every single one of the Academy Award winning films up until that year.
Oh.
So I don't know. Yeah. Like, are you heavy into, like, classics as well, or?
Yeah, I do love classics. I don't know. I'm very interested in the history of film, and it's cool to see where inspirations are stemmed through, mm-hmm. you know? I don't know. So I always kind of find that stuff interesting as well. Trying to think of one of the class. I mean, since it's, I'm not sure when you're airing this episode, but I know Christmas time, it's like White Christmas is one that I'm a huge fan of.
Yeah.
Oh, that's my great fun. Grandma's
yeah.
favorite movie.
Really?
She had my mom, my mom lived with her grandma, and they used to joke with her because she had a crush on Bing Crosby. They're like, ooh, grandma. Oh, she's just like, oh, he's just so cute. Like, it's so sweet. I grew up watching that one.
There's like an insane age difference, though, between the girls and the guys. Bing Crosby's like 50 in the film. I mean, he always looked 50 from the start of his entire life. Like, he always just looked like an old man.
Born that way, it was shocking.
Yeah, he just looked like an old man since birth. But he was definitely, he was like 52, I think, when they made the film. And Rosemary Clooney, I think, is in like 28, maybe. Like, it's a weird age difference. And nobody thought anything of it.
Yeah.
We're just like, that makes sense.
I didn't realize that Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall were like 28 years apart or something.
Oh, really?
The reason I found this out was because everyone's been giving Leonardo DiCaprio's girlfriend a really hard time because they're like 28, 29 years apart or something. And she's been posting like all these things on Instagram about like, you know, Fred Astaire and Ginger and like people who had like 20, 30 year age differences that no one thought about or talked about or made a big deal out of.
Yeah.
Well, in the original Sabrina, it was Audrey Hepburn and Humphrey Bogart, and there was a big age difference. Some people are talking about like a George Clooney and his wife. There's an age difference, but she's still like in her 40s or
30s. She's like 39 or something. Yeah.
But there's still like almost a 20-year age difference or something. I don't know. So something was kind of big. But she also looks like a woman who's lived. So, you know, it's like he didn't get her out of the factory, like, fresh.
She looks like a mature, normal 39-year-old woman, not a Barbie doll or something.
Right.
I mean, pretty,
Blade Runner 2020 just, like, flopped out of a pouch thing.
Oh, my God. Speaking of, not of Blade Runner, but age differences, Keanu Reeves is... partner, I guess, is
around the same age.
So no, what I love about this—that's the point. So what I love about this is two things. One, she's like 43, and she has like gray hair. She's just letting it like gray.
Yeah.
Looks good.
And number two, everyone's like, oh my God, he's dating someone his age. She's 15 years younger than him, but people are still like, oh, he's dating someone the same age.
Oh my God, what? I didn't realize there was that. I didn't realize there was an age difference at all.
It might be 10. It might be 10, which I've never thought 10 was a lot because my parents are 10 apart, and I just think it's hilarious.
Yeah.
But, like, she's still 10 years younger than him, and everyone's like, they're the same age. And I'm like, no, they're fucking not. No, they're not.
Oh, my God.
I like it. I don't know if you guys ever saw House Moving Castle. Maybe it's a nerd thing. But it was, like, the main character, she, like, turns, like, she gets a curse on her and then she's old and then but she like has moments where she's young and she has gray hair and then he has like shoulder length black hair and then people were putting pictures of like the House Moving Castle character. It's like a like House Moving Moving Castle and then the Keanu Reeves and his girlfriend. I'm like,
oh my god. So like, I don't know if you've experienced this at least with film, and then I want to talk more about TV too. Yeah. Like, you were talking earlier about when film, like Birdcage, like stuff from 20, 25 years ago, how it's still relevant today. And what I find personally fascinating is when things are 30, 40, 50, 60 years old, and they're still extremely relevant today. What I struggle with, and this is something we've been talking a lot about as I've been trying to get more into like acting and you know, the entertainment sort of sector, is that, you know, while the message or a lot of the writing is good, there's stuff that still doesn't age well. And I think a lot of it for me is like acting. I don't know if you agree. I think acting now is better than it ever was in sort of the Hollywood golden era. I don't know if you agree with that or if you have different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I agree with it to a certain extent. It's the acting, and it was also the dialogue of the time was just very heavy. And I remember because I actually took an acting for the camera class while I was in college, and we had to choose film scenes, and I chose, I think it was From Charade, the Audrey Hepburn. Was it Cary Grant who's in it with her? I know, I think it's Cary Grant, but it's just like a, I think we're supposed to pick some sort of like mystery film, and this is like a mystery film that's also kind of a comedy as well, and it's just a little bit over the top, but it since it's like an old classic film, it's kind of muted at the same time while being over the top. It's just interesting because I chose this scene, and it doesn't, it didn't play well. Like, it just didn't really, we couldn't ever nail it because it was such an old-timey dialogue that even, we're obviously a college student actors, you know, nothing compared to Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, but it just was awful because we couldn't nail that dialogue whatsoever. It wasn't to our sensibilities. Whereas, and then I think the teacher was like, why don't you just try this scene from Pulp Fiction? And he was like, if you, man, if you. And he was like, yeah, those college students can get this much better. Like, it was like the diner scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That diner scene is the classic. Like, so I did, I watched, I don't know if you ever have seen the MasterClass app or the MasterClass website.
Oh, yes. I paid for like a year subscription.
Me too.
On that.
Me too. Did you watch?
I had suckered into that one.
Did you watch the Sam Jackson one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they did the diner scene. Yep. They did the diner scene. And are you super heavy into award season? Like, do you care?
The only one I watch is the Oscars. And I just, that one is, I remember watching that since I was a kid, and I was the only one who actually cared in my family, and I was like, come on, guys, let's, like, can we stay up late and watch this, and, you know, my family was like, oh, my God, we don't want to, and, yeah, I mean, so I've always, and it's not even so much really following, I don't know why I care, like, it's one of those things that I don't get so worked up when things go wrong or whatever, but I don't know. I just always was interested in that one.
Like, I need to.
And then it was fun out in LA because I was, when I lived out in LA for a little bit, I was surrounded by people who cared. And I was surrounded by people who were actually working on the films that were, I worked on one film that was nominated. I worked on Bad Grandpa, the Jackass film.
That's so great.
That is an Oscar nominated film. It got nominated for Best Makeup.
Oh my God.
It deserved it. They did it. They had the makeup crew on that was fantastic. But anyways, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, when going out to L.A., it was like everybody wore formal dresses. We'd all get together and, like, go to someone's house and watch movies.
I thought it was funny in L.A. when I was visiting Jess that, like, they, like, for the Academy or all this stuff, like, people put up billboards, like, for the...
Oh, yeah.
For people to, like, vote for their movie, which, because apparently all the judges are, like, living in that neighborhood. Like, what the heck? It's something I've never seen before.
I loved that. It was, like, all these billboards, like, for your consideration, check out The Good Wife or whatever. Yeah, it's, like, such a difference, because out here in Ohio, it's like, did you get hurt in a personal accident? You need a lawyer? Like, that's all the billboards
out
there.
Did you know hell is real?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
1-800-GEOS or something.
That's what I was going to say, is hell is real.
Oh, my God. There used to be one up, like, near Columbus. I remember because I got off to get gas or something. I saw it getting, back on the highway, and it was something about porn, and like right
real men
immediately
real men don't need porn. Yep. No, oh, that's right by my parents' house. My parents live there off 71. There is a sign for an adult. It's the Lion's Den. And
it said
real men don't need porn in really big letters over top of it.
Oh my god!
I always forget Ohio's like weird like that until I leave Cleveland, and I'm like, oh yeah.
Right.
I would say all of the rural areas of every state, though, because there are definitely areas of California you will run into, like,
oh yeah,
Jesus-y, yeah, this and that. Did you move to LA to get involved in performing?
Well, actually, I went out there to do film production. I studied film production in college with a minor in theater, and so I went out there to specifically work behind the scenes. I hadn't done any stand-up comedy back then, but when I moved out there, I started taking classes at Second City, which that stems all the way back to childhood as well, because I, again, I was interested in SNL, I had a Second City book, and I just, like, was very, always wanted to study there. So I started taking classes in the Hollywood branch, and thinking, like, oh, it's just a good way, just something fun to do, you know, meet some friends. And then I went through the program all the way up to the end, and then afterwards, like, everyone I knew was jumping over to the next levels or the next schools or the next, it was that constant doing it, and I kind of was just like, what can I do alone and free? Because at that point, I just couldn't keep going with the classes, and so that's when I started trying stand-up and found real love for it. I was like, oh, wow, I can't believe I never really even considered stand-up as a thing for me, because I was so much more fascinated with production wise of films and TV. So stand up, just a solo person on a stage, boring, you know. But once I got on there, I was like, this is what I've been wanting to do. It's like control of my own stories.
Yeah, you don't have to rely on anyone else. You don't need any equipment. Yes. Like, show up and it's you.
It's just you, and you, it gave me the best of both worlds of my own, you know, I get that sort of production feel because I get to control, like, where I'm going up and what I'm doing, and then I also get the performance aspect of it and the acting and the story writing out of it, so it really kind of covered all of it without relying on other people, which I loved, and still do. So,
projects are the worst.
Yeah, right? I'm like, well, other people. But, so then that's how I got into stand-up, and I loved it. And, I mean, I keep saying past tense. I don't know why, because I'm just telling the story. But, I love it, and got involved that way. I still am doing film production, but actually in a weird way that I never thought I would be involved. I run social media for a couple different, for Vanishing Angle, which is a independent film studio that's getting a lot of awards and I was their operations manager there for a while when I was in LA, and then once I moved back I had taken on their social media, and so I just stayed with it. So I run their social media, and then a few other clients I do social media for. One's a film that a friend of mine is about to launch a WeFunder campaign for, which is cool. It's like Kickstarter, but you actually get investor credit for. And so hers is a really cool, interesting story, about, two, like, an ex-couple who,
Mom.
Sorry, real quick. Oh. I know, I need you. I gotta jump on this rainbow rocking horse.
It's very important.
Yeah, very, very important. it's the story of this, ex-couple, they hadn't, like, interacted in years, and it is following sort of what happened. It all takes place in one night. It, like, discovers what went on in the relationship, why the one person left, and you know this from the start, but one person was trans, and so, you know, he was a man when they were dating, became a woman, and it's the ex-girlfriend kind of trying to wrap her head around what happened, and, yeah, and sort of, it is a really cool script.
It seems like a story that a lot more people can relate to nowadays, but nobody's really told that, like publicly.
Yeah, and it's a very quiet film. Like I said, it all takes place in one night, and it's all just about self-discovery within both of them, like what they feel about themselves and the situation and where they are now. Their hopes and dreams. It's just a very interesting film. And so a friend of mine's making it. She asked me to start doing their social media, and I was like, yeah. And I read the script, and I was like, oh, yeah, definitely. Good. Because that's always the hard part sometimes when you work on films, you're like, I hope I like this.
Yeah.
I hope I'm actually a fan of this film.
It'll probably make your job a lot easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a really great point.
So that film's called See You Then.
Okay.
It hasn't launched on WeFunder yet, but it's coming out soon, and it should be fun.
Sweet. That sounds awesome. So how long were you in L.A. working in film production?
I lived in L.A. for 5 years. I started doing film production out in Ohio. I was lucky enough that when I graduated college, we got the tax incentives. So right away I jumped on Alex Cross. That was also the same year that Avengers was in town, but I didn't go on that. So yeah, it was when Avengers was in production. That's how long ago. Now we're
the first one.
We're literally 10 years into.
Yeah.
I jumped on those films and made a bunch of connections and was able to move out to LA and start working on films there. I actually did a lot more reality TV when I first moved out there. I worked on MasterChef. I worked on the Jim Henson Creature Shop Challenge, which that was a dream. Because I got to be on the Henson lot in the Creature Shop.
Oh, my God. freaked out.
Okay,
it was so cool.
So less wholesomely, a new weed cafe opened up across the street from Jim Henson's Imaginarium or whatever it is. And so one night we went there, and then afterwards we went across the street and stood outside and took pictures of like the Kermit statue and all that stuff.
Oh yeah,
so amped.
Uh huh. That's a cool space. That studio used to be the Charlie Chaplin studio as well. So like, it is just deep with film history there.
I love history.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's so cool.
I love
it. So what kind of like when you say production work, like what kind of stuff did you do?
Well, so I was mostly a production assistant on that stuff. Like that was what I was doing in the Jim Henson Creature Shop. I actually just, my job on that was just to follow Brian Henson around and go, they need you now. Sir, could you go to set? They're ready for you. That's all. Just nervous child just asking this like incredibly talented person to please go on set. That was mostly my job there. I did a lot of production work. I did assistant director for a while on like smaller films, short films. And then that's when I started to realize that I was on this fast track to be an assistant director, which is very, you have to be a very type A person. You have to be very organized. You have to be very good with time. You have to be very good with like knowing who's where at what and like who needs to be in the makeup chair and who needs, you know, and you're thinking ahead. And I just was like, no, this is not me. I'm not very organized. I am horrible with time. Like, nope. If I don't get that flashing light while I'm on stage, I'm like, have I been up here for 10 minutes? Have I been up here for an hour? I have no idea. Like, I'm not, I have no sense of time. So it was like not a good fit for me. And so that's when I started looking in. And I also, I started really loving stand-up at that point, and I was finding the struggle of doing all this freelance, you know, production stuff while I was also then at the same time trying to book comedy shows, because you just never know, you just never know what your schedule is going to be like when you're freelance. So then I moved on to, that's when I started at Vanishing Angle, because my roommate at the time had worked with them as a production designer, and she's like, oh, yeah, they're looking for an office manager. Do you want to step in and, apply for it? And I was like, yeah. And I ended up working there for 3 years as their operations manager until I moved back.
I mean, that sounds nice because you're kind of getting involved in the industry, but in a way that allows to have a consistent sort of, you know what I mean, like, schedule.
Yeah. Yeah. And working there was so much fun because they're a group of people who are all just film nerds, and everybody really cares and is really passionate about filmmaking. And so even for me, who was in the non-creative aspect, like I wasn't writing any scripts or, you know, getting anything of my own made or doing, you know, I was just there running the office and doing accounting work and, you know, that kind of stuff. I was still able to get this creative fix just because everybody there was so passionate about it. And you know, we would all watch a film. We'd, like, assign a film a week. We'd watch it together, watch a movie, and then we'd talk about it.
That's
and,
awesome.
You know, they have a script lab where we would all write stuff and get together and read each other's work. And so they're a very cool company in those regards, but they're always trying to keep everybody creative because anyone who's there working in film loves film. So.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
So it sounds like you haven't lost your love for film, you know, having been exposed to sort of the behind-the-scenes element of it. You just kind of realized that the things you thought you might want to do in the behind-the-scenes element weren't really for you, pretty much.
Yeah. And really the truth was that I got into that aspect just because I was scared of what I actually wanted to do. Because really when I was obsessed with growing up, and they say, like, whatever you're obsessed with when you're young is usually what your calling is, you know? And the stuff that I was more obsessed with was the actual writing, it was the actual performances. And so for me to, like, go in, I was always curious about the other stuff, how things are made. Oh, my goodness. Now my cat's on me.
Mom!
Everybody wants me. I could do a whole separate podcast on, like, trying to keep being a comedian in a family. performance. Yeah, that was what I was more interested in growing up. But when it was like around high school time when I started like expressing that that's actually what I wanted to pursue, that's when I started getting in from being from Ohio where we're just not surrounded by that. It was like, wait, what? No, well, so what's your backup plan? Like, what do you? Yeah, yeah. And I remember senior year, we had to like write a report on like what we were going to do. We had to write like our career path, and we had to provide three options because they wanted to make sure we had backup plans.
Oh.
Like so. Right. I know. Like, let's make sure you have backup plans. So I know one of them was, I said I wanted to be, you know, an actor and a comedian as one. And then I can't remember what my third one was. I don't even think I submitted anything. But I know I know one of them was actor and comedian. And then the other one was, I'm going to take over Switzerland.
Nice.
Because I felt like that had my best chance. Taking over Switzerland and declaring myself queen of Switzerland.
Hell yeah.
And I like broke down my like 5-year plan of taking over Switzerland. I think I only submitted those two.
I've definitely
failed it.
Like, this is dumb and blah, blah, blah. Like, and world domination. So.
World domination.
Yeah, so it's like, all right.
Why the hell?
Always,
not?
It's always a plan, you know?
Yeah.
It's like always.
If you have to have a backup, why not dream big?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, right, exactly.
tried the normal thing. That didn't work, so fall back on world domination. So nothing just happened. We were continuing to talk, just like we normally were.
It was completely, you know, seamless.
Yeah.
Totally.
Conversation.
You know what I think is interesting about film stuff is there's so many jobs in like film that like I never knew existed, you know, like there's so many people who work on stuff and I'm like, oh wait, like I never knew part of my dream job would be what do they call it? I don't know, it's like a set historian, basically like you're a specialist on like history, and then when they're making something in that historical period, they bring you in as a consultant. I'm like, that sounds awesome.
One of the projects I worked on at Vanishing Angle was Stargate Origins, the most recent version of it. Yeah, and it was the best thing was I got to speak with the historian on that project, the Egyptologist specialist, who worked on The Mummy, which I was saying earlier is the reason I got into filmmaking. He worked on pretty much like if there is a film about Egypt, this is the guy they call. And I got to talk to him.
Not,
he was
you know,
so cool. And
it just
was so like chill, and I was like, what's the coolest thing you discovered on a dig, thinking he was going to be like, oh, a vase or something, and he was like, a civilization, and I was like, oh.
What, that's all? That's fine.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
No big deal.
And then he told me, like, he discovered the civilization, and then they, like, ran out of funding, and so he had to kind of, like, hide it again until he could, like, go
until
back.
He did,
like, he did the thing that I do at like Target where it's like, oh, I can't afford this right now. Just like put it in the back of the hangar and I'll come back and the paycheck is here. You know, like, nice. No one will find it. He did that with a civilization.
Amazing. Oh my God. Yeah,
we're like, I feel like those people have to be so cool.
Yeah.
So interesting. But I had a fortunate I was lucky enough to speak at my high school recently on their career day.
Aww.
And I basically was just saying, like, whatever interest you have, there is a job in filmmaking for you. Because there literally are just so much. Yeah, and we're pretty much only taught, like, actor, director, writer, producers, like, an editor. Like, those are the ones that we only ever hear about. But there's just so much.
I feel like even producer, like it encompasses so much.
Oh, yeah.
Different kinds. Oh, right. That whenever people say producer, I'm like, yeah, but what do you do?
Well, and that's a fun thing from a perspective of resume building I found. Because like when I'm set, like working on my IMDb page, like we've been writing and filming our own sketches out here. And it's like, well, fuck, man, I'm a multi-hyphenate. I directed that shit. I wrote that shit. I produced that shit. Like, I don't even know.
Do it all.
Yeah. Like, so you just put all that stuff in there. But I was going to ask, so, like, it sounds like comedy is the first place you sort of opened up to the prospect of actually getting involved in the creative process.
Yeah, Uh-huh. I think that was the place that, because even when I took classes at Second City, I made that sort of excuse in my head. I'm like, oh, this is just to, you know, meet people in LA. And it's, you know, this is just for fun because I've always wanted to do it. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. And, you know, of course, then I got into it and I was like, okay, give me a scene. I'm ready. Like, I'm over the top into it.
Yeah, that's normal. Like, you do something like that. Like, you try to keep your expectations low for yourself. Yeah. So that it does, you're not like setting yourself up for disappointment. You end up being like, I didn't want it anyway. Like, that's what I was going for.
So yeah, that's when I started at Second City. I definitely did that. I was kind of like, oh no, it's just I'm just here. And then I think I was in Second City program for 2 or 3 years before I started doing stand up. It was definitely a while. And then once I started doing stand up, I was like, yes, this feels right. And there's just been enough. At that point, I had that permission. I'd given myself permission to really, you know, study it, follow it, do it as a career. Yeah. So that got my start in L.A. doing comedy. And then I moved back to Ohio.
I was about to say, again, there's some irony in finding out that you love performing when you get to L.A. and then deciding to move. And I feel like I know sort of the story was that you had a surprise when you were here.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I talk about it in my stand-up a lot, though.
I love that.
If I go into bits on accident, it's just because it's like so ingrained in my head. But I had an IUD, and it's a 1% failure rate with this IUD, and we
like
made the
1%. Anything else except not having.
We made the 1%, and we have a baby now, which is been the most amazing adventure. Like it's even though she has been a constant interruption in this podcast, she is so much fun. I never really thought about, I don't know, I was like, oh yeah, kids, like maybe, I don't know, and now that I have one, I'm like, this is awesome. Just because us comedians, we're so dark and weird, and then we're like, oh, life, you know, and it's fun having a little person being like, what's this light? Oh my gosh, how cool, you know?
Yeah, someone who's like excited about it still.
Yeah, like the day she discovered you had hands, I was like, yeah, this is a thing, you know? Stared at them for hours.
They're like tiny little like smoking buddies. Like you're just like, whoa, look at my hands, and you're like, oh,
what do we got?
I remember when you got here and you were pregnant and you performed a bit, which was cool. And then, but then you had the baby, and she's so cute.
Thank you.
I was seeing all your Facebook posts. She's just adorable. I hope I don't have an ugly baby if I have a baby. Because
I've seen pulling me around this entire.
I will say, like,
entire podcast.
As someone,
I've seen a baby that looks like an iguana.
Well, no, what I was gonna say is my best friend. She's about to have another one, so I'm real interested to see how this goes down. But 6 years ago, she had a baby, and I swear to God, that child was the weirdest looking kid. And the thing was, I think she even knew it because she was never the mom that would be like, look how cute. She would always just be like, look at him. Like, I think she knew.
Yeah.
And he was the weirdest looking kid until he was at least 2. Like, I can't even begin to tell you. He looked like Don Rickles. Like, he just was like, just a weird looking kid. And like, then all of a sudden, it was like 4 or 5. I looked at him and I was like, not only do you look normal, but you are going to smash in college. You are going to smash so much ass when you get to college. Yeah, he's like a good-looking kid. So I think there are, like, even if we all end up with ugly babies, like, eventually,
they have potential.
Eventually it's ugly duckling syndrome, or you just get naturally cute babies. You know what? I've seen very few kids that are cute babies that turn into ugly adults. I'm sure it happens. I just haven't seen it happen that often. So you either cute from like day one, or you grow into your looks, or you're just always ugly. You never know. You could just always be ugly forever. But usually there's someone for everyone.
Well, but you know what? And to circle it back around the film, though, even if you're like, look at Steve Buscemi's career. That guy is not an attractive gentleman, but
I'm sorry.
Killing it.
I'm sorry. Buscemi can get it. He I'm sorry. I can't explain what it is, and I know it's me.
Finally talented.
I'm into
that's why.
Unorthodox looking guys. But also, because I also love Rami Malek. Like, Rami Malek is just for me, just does it. But I think it was also Boardwalk Empire that got me like super into Buscemi, because he was just such like a stud in like Boardwalk Empire. So
I like his older goofy part, like, you know, like even like Fargo and stuff. Like,
he's just,
what is it? Like Big Lebowski and stuff like that.
Oh my god,
side character or something. But he's such like a scene stealer too.
He always
like,
dies somehow, you know, hilariously. And I loved him. I still think his favorite, and this was like his tiny role, was Billy Madison. When he calls, he's got the list of people I want to kill, and he just crosses off Billy Madison, and he slowly starts putting on lipstick like over his whole face, and then just sits back.
I liked him too in Big Daddy too. He was a scene stealer in that, where he was just like homeless guy, and but when they brought him into the court case, that was my favorite part, where he was like, wow, I really, you know, oh, I don't know, maybe it wasn't a court case.
I was talking to him.
Yeah, he started out with my father, and he like goes into this like deep analysis of himself.
Buscemi's amazing. So it was one of those things where you guys found out you were pregnant, and then you decided you wanted to move back home.
We decided we wanted to move back home. It was incredibly hard decision. I didn't want to leave. I, you know, had established a life there, but at the same time, we just knew we needed the help. Like, we needed to be around family for support. We knew financially wise, we were not ready to have a kid there. We were living in Van Nuys in a bachelor apartment that was like this, like very small room with like a lofted bed that we couldn't even like sit up in. We'd like hit our heads on the ceiling. Like, it was. So, but it was only $500 a month, which is, like, unheard of in LA. Super cheap. Yeah, with a parking space. What? These are the things that, like, in Ohio, that's my sister's mortgage. It was so expensive out there, and we just knew we wanted to, you know, see what happened. And it's one of those things that, like, I knew we needed to go. I wasn't sure why. And it's all worked out amazingly because, like I said, we're around my family. And we also, like, comedy-wise, I never expected to be able to perform as much as I am. Because in L.A., like, you can find shows and open mics every night, but you're also competing against the highest performers that there are.
Also.
And a lot.
Yeah.
That's
a lot of them.
So that was me. So what ended up happening is we came out here to visit like 3 months before we actually moved, and I was trying to find open mics. And the thing is, there are open mics, yes, but there's, I think, two elements at play. One is that everything is so spread out, it's actually harder to find things than it is in Cleveland, because everything is kind of more Justin Lakewood,
pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So everything's so spread out that it's harder to find things. But then also, it's because everything is so spread out makes it a transient city, which is to say, no one at least 5 nights a week is going to drive to wherever the fuck to go see a open mic, when they could just go any night of the week to Laugh Factory, and actually see Kevin
Flappers,
Nealon.
That was my home club.
So Flappers, we went to, we came to visit in April, and sorry, I have something in my eye, but
the podcast, I can't see you.
That's true. The thing is that they had an open mic, I don't know. It seemed like it was well advertised. I think it was almost every night, I think. It was multiple nights a week. So I thought, okay, you know, if they have this every week, it'll be less packed, I guess. So we went, and I think 128 people showed up, and they said that's usually normal for a Friday. So what ended up happening, of course, and as I understand most shows are like this, they just draw 30 names, and whoever's 30 names get drawn, they get 3 minutes, and then you're done.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that all sort of combined into like a grand sum of me deciding I wanted to get more acquainted with improv and acting and things like that. There's a bunch of other elements that go along with it, but that was a big piece of it. So, and I'm interested, were you able to find stand-up pretty easily based off your Second City contacts, or how did you come up with that?
That's what I was going to ask, too.
Let's see, I'm trying to remember now, how did I get... I don't really... Well, my first open mic, I went with a friend from Second City who did a little bit of stand-up. She's actually now transitioned into more filmmaking. Noreen Tarzi is her name. She's very, very funny. She works at, I think she was working at CBS for a while, too, in their late night shows. So, but she was very, very funny. And so she was like, you want to do stand-up? Like, come, just go do it. What are you, you know, she's from L.A. So she's like, well, I don't understand what the big deal. So she took me to my first open mic, which was great. But then after that, I just started going to places and meeting other comedians. I went, there's a women's only open mic, the Dallas Comedy Studio. That's in, well, they moved since then. I think it was in like West Hollywood at the time, but I think they've moved. But yeah, it's a women only open mic. So for me, that was one of those things that as I was, well, here's why. At first mic I went to, it was all guys except for me and my friend. And we kept getting guys, like, one guy shouted at us. He's like, I don't understand why you two girls are doing this. You're both pretty. It was like, what?
What?
He literally said that to me.
Even here, like, sometimes going to open mics, it's just, like, all dudes.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a lot of times.
Not
like,
sometimes. Yeah. Most times. Yeah.
Most of the time. Like, even on when people book shows, it's like you show up and it's just like,
it's a lot of dudes.
Forgot to book a lady on the show. Do you want to do
that's what I do love about Marcella Aguello's Woman Crush Wednesdays at the Improv.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Liz Blanc came out and did that a few months ago, and that was the first time I went.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing, and I love, like, she always advertises for it on Twitter, Marcella, and it's always like, no men, never, stop asking, like, that's like the whole, like, tagline, there will never be a man on the show.
Stop asking.
Yeah, so.
Yeah.
That's great.
And it's when I moved back to Ohio, I put on one of those, like, Akron and Cleveland comedy scene Facebook groups, so I was like, hey, I just moved back, like, you know, are there any women only or women friendly mics is what I wrote on there. And I got a lot of like pushback from guys being like, oh, you can't play with the guys. And like, oh, yeah, that's ridiculous.
I remember seeing that post. I remember someone was like, oh God, LA rots your brain or something like that.
Oh,
and I was like,
my thing
is whenever I see stuff like that, I go to the guy's page real quick and I'm like, oh, you're not fucking anybody. Okay, got it. Like, it's like, just to make sure, like,
I think I even wrote on there, like, look, guys, like, I didn't mean to make you guys, like, really question yourselves or, you know, get so insecure, but, like, I'm just trying to figure out what are the mics that I'm going to be able to make it to my car safely afterwards. Like, I'm not trying to figure out, like, I just want to know what's the mics that I'm going to feel safe at. Because that is a thing that men don't have to deal with at open mics. I have gone to mics in comedy shows before where I'm like, I don't feel safe here. I'm the only girl. I don't know anybody. You know, like, I've had people come up to my car. I did one comedy show where somebody charged the stage, lifted me up, carried me off the stage out to the parking lot, and then he was drunk and he dropped me.
Stop.
Jesus Christ!
And nobody, like, did anything. And then the booker came out and he was like, oh my God, like, leave, like, made the guy, like, leave. And then he's like, started hitting on me. And I was like, I'm done with this show.
Okay. The fact that you're still doing stand-up comedy speaks volumes, though, to your resilience, because one of the other contributing factors to me quitting is the oft-mentioned last show I ever did at Avenue Tap House, where we got shot glasses thrown, where we got batteries thrown, and I had to have somebody walk me to my car.
Spiders!
Yeah, because we were afraid we were going to get the shit beat out of us by two people who were mad that we couldn't play pool while we were all performing stand-up. So, like, that kind of shit, like, I love that you're still just like, fuck it. Like, I'm going to keep going.
One of my favorite experiences that was similar to that, though, was it was my first time hosting anything. I hosted this bar show, and, I can't remember the guy's name. A comedian, very funny. He's out in L.A. His name's Mikey, and he's Mikey and Teddy's comedy show is what it's, if you guys want to look it up, it's very funny. But so Mikey, I can't remember his last name, but he was out there, and he's gay, and he said some sort of word. I can't remember, I think he said twink or some sort of, like, you know, whatever word, and we're in this kind of rural area bar, and this guy, like, jumps up. He's like, what did you just say? What was that? And he kind of, like, charges the bar or the stage. And I, being a new host, I was like, oh, my God, what do? I kind of stand up, like, getting ready to get in between these guys, thinking I'm going to break up this fight between these two guys, this, like, big cowboy-looking guy. And Mikey just very calmly was like, sir, I don't understand. Are you asking in this because you're angry and offended, or do you just not understand what I'm saying? And he goes, I don't understand what you're saying. And he's like, oh, okay, well, a twink means, and he, like, describes it. And the guy was like, oh, well, okay. And then, like, when he sat back down, and I was like, I think we just, like, helped this man figure out who he was. You know? And then he just, like, was like, oh, revelation. My God, that's me. And I want to know what you're talking about. I can't remember what word he used.
That's amazing. Okay, that's the best story I've ever heard from any of
them. Well, because, I mean, there's, like, moments like that, though, that it's, like, hecklers, they can completely depress you, and they can be just obnoxious and annoying, and 95% of them are like that. But then there's also this, like, you know, 5% of them that bring that kind of aspect to it, and you're like, okay, yeah, like, I don't know, it just reminds you that why you're doing comedy, to, like, connect experiences together, to connect people together.
I love it.
Yeah, it's
that's
fun like
so
that.
Good. Mm-hmm. So,
hey. I know, but that's, like, even, oh, sorry, Jess.
No, go ahead, please, you go.
I was just gonna say, like, when it comes to, like, doing comedy shows, like, even if you're, like hosting or helping produce it, but you're, like, a lady and there's just all these dudes, and then they start, you're like, oh my God, like, start shitting on each other, like, they're gonna get in a fight, and you're like, I'm 5'3". Like, what am I gonna do? And it's just like, a more experienced comedian came in the one time when this was happening, and, like, took the one guy outside to, like, talk, and, like, oh, he's fine.
Yeah.
I was gonna do to help.
One other thing I was gonna say real quick, because we're talking about the whole men thing. I love this sort of, like, weird dichotomy of, like, I'm not insecure, I don't need, like, but yet they have to tell you that they're not. And the thing that makes me think of that is that you're talking about, like, the women only showcase, or the women only showcases you're kind of looking for. Liz Blanc, I don't know if she still does, but at one time she was doing all women Sunday brunches where it was all female comedians, and we would do Sunday brunch.
She hasn't done that.
Yeah, and it's hard because she would do it, like, once a month, and it just got really hard to coordinate, you know, so many people every 4 weeks. But it was great, and we had a lot of fun, and, you know, we just spent, like, you know, time shitting on, you know, weird men in the community, which was fun. But Liz, you know, Liz, and I think it was actually Mary's idea, but Liz organized it, and so Mary posts it on Cleveland Akron Comedy page, and oh my God, it was like
the pushback.
I don't know if you're familiar with, like, hunters and how they run into bushes to, like, flush out birds. It was like she did that, but with, like, really insecure men. Because, like, all of a sudden, like, out of the woodwork comes, like, oh, well, I'm just going to show up anyway. What are you going to do about it? And just, like, all, like, this shit. And we were just like, so finally I was like, all right, I'm announcing an all-female showcase at the Avenue Tap House. so that way I can ensure at least two or three men show up to the show, because half the time people wouldn't show up to my showcase anyway.
Right. They'd get scheduled
and then not show up. I was like, just make everything all women now, and the guys will actually just show up all the time. They'll always be there.
Yeah.
They'll
be mad about it. Like, we get some in our
mad the whole time.
And I think that is something that it's an Ohio thing, I think, for sure. Because in L.A., there's so many, like, I pretty much was only booked on women-only shows. Like, I at Flappers, I was hosting, I hosted a little black dress show a few times, and I hosted the Cookies and Sweatpants show. And it was, like, all women in pajamas, and there was just so many women-only things. And then, like I said, the Dow Comedy Studio, like, I did shows there all the time. Monday nights is women-only mic. Like, it's just such a different thing, and nobody thinks anything of it. I'm sure you get the like, occasional dudes saying stuff or whatever, but, like, for the most part, nobody really cares. And it was almost so much to a point where I kind of was tired of doing the women-only shows because I was doing so many of them out in L.A. that I kind of was like, all right, like, I want to just get on a show and not just, hey, here's some funny women, you know, and be categorized. Yeah. Like, I just want to be like, here's some comedians. And then when I came out here, I kind of was like, well, I miss those. I miss them because instead, like, we're getting a lot more, you know, you get more pushback.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the positive that Ohio is paid work. There's a ton more work.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised by that. I wasn't expecting that at all. But, like, I get paid for almost all the shows I'm on out here.
Ooh la la! Look at you! You're
not
fancy.
Not the case in L.A. It was like, do you want maybe a beer for payment? Like, maybe?
Hey, speaking of getting paid for shows, do you have any coming up in the next month or so?
Yeah, so I host every 3 months. I host a show at Lockport Brewery down in Bolivar, Sandsworth, Canton, Ohio area. So I've got that coming up. I'm also hosting at the Funny Bone Funny Bone. I was like, wait a second, did I say that? I should know the names of the clubs I'm on. This is like comedy business 101. But the Funny Bone in Youngstown, I'm performing there on December 19th. I'm hosting that show.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any social media you want anybody to follow you on?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, well, you can find me at Kelly Thulis. That's my personal social media page. But then I was like, and then there's like five other social accounts. If you want to give a follow, that's all the stuff I manage. The social media manager. If you like my work and you want to, you know, hear me talk in a voice about a film production company or something, message me and I will send you links to Vanishing Angle or Steve N or any of the other accounts that I manage.
Awesome. Check out all those things. Liz, you got anything you want to promote?
No.
Okay, cool. I am...
You see that posted on Instagram,
dude, she's
though.
Been blowing Instagram the you fuck up. Check out at Elizabeth Seaman on Instagram.
Like, now, once every, like, 2 weeks I put something
this is,
up
like, an obnoxious amount of posts for her. You guys need to understand.
Yeah.
This is... Oh, man. I want... Okay. I already follow you, but I'm going to make sure I
content.
Get on there so that way you're up on the algorithm.
She's been generating content.
That's the hard thing. Because I manage so many accounts, I, like, my personal account has just... failed. I think the last thing was like, oh, here's a show in November was like the last thing I posted.
That's
that was
a
like,
really
lame.
Good point. You have
to be
careful.
Myself down.
Yeah, you have to be careful when you manage like business social media that like the
wires
don't cross and you're like, hey everyone, come see my tits this weekend at Chuckle Fucks. And then everyone's like, Kelly, that went out on our investors website.
Oh yeah. I definitely did that once before.
Oh my god, that's cool. That's awesome. You can find me at Epic Fall on Instagram, Twitter. You can find us at The Default Setting Pod on Facebook. And I think that's it. I want to thank you so much, Kelly Thulis, for being our guest today. You're amazing.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
But yeah, I want to thank OK Pants for doing our logo. I want to thank Above Below Entertainment. K, love you. Bye.
Bye. No.